This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up on a special edition of Wisconsin Life, the story of cassette tapes that connected a Wisconsin man with his family's Ho-Chunk heritage. Now, President Biden announced yesterday that the U.S. would ban all imports of Russian oil and gas effective immediately.
We're banning all imports of Russian oil and gas and energy. That means Russian oil will no longer be acceptable at U.S. ports, and the American people will deal another powerful blow to Putin's war machine.
The European Union also pledged to cut Europe's consumption of Russian energy by two-thirds by the end of this year. That's a tall order, though, because Europe uses a lot of fuel from Russia, with some countries getting as much as 80% of their energy needs met by Russian fuel. The U.S. is not as dependent on Russian oil and gas, but Americans will see gas prices continue to rise as a result of the ban. We're talking about American and European sanctions on the third largest producer of oil in the world, and we want to hear what you think at 800-642-1234. Do you support this ban on Russian oil and gas imports? Are you okay with paying more at the gas pump if it means not relying on Russian energy? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Jonathan Elkind is a senior research scholar at the Center on Global Energy Policy at Columbia University. From 2009 to 2017, he worked on international energy and climate issues at the U.S. Department of Energy. He was also U.S. Assistant Secretary for International Affairs from 2015 to 17. John, thanks for joining us today.
It's my pleasure to be with you.
Up till yesterday, the Biden administration said they were not looking at banning Russian energy imports, in part because of the fear of the impact on American consumers. Why this change in strategy?
Well, I think that the Biden administration, as the rest of us, have been watching with utter horror the development of Russia's attack on a peaceful neighbor, namely Ukraine. And so I think that the sentiment in the White House and in lots of European capitals as well has been that additional measures were needed to make very plain that this is not a time for business as usual with Russia.
Now, the gas we fill our tank with, odds are it didn't come from Russia. We're not their biggest customer. About how much Russian oil ends up here in the U.S. economy?
So the share of U.S. Crude oil and refined products, that's the geeky term for gasoline, diesel, et cetera, that comes from Russia is about 7-8%. It varies. That was the number throughout 2021. Interestingly, since the start of the year, U.S. refiners and distributors have basically dropped those numbers to somewhere pretty close to zero, even in advance of the White House sanctions that were instituted about a week and a half ago. Purchasers of crude oil and refined product in the United States had real concerns about the possibility of sanctions and about the possibility of being caught on the wrong side. So since the sanctions have been instituted even more so, there's been this kind of over-compliance, people doing more than was required of them. Now, of course, we have the ban that President Biden instituted yesterday that will phase in the coming weeks. So the numbers, I think, will stay low and go firmly to zero.
Flipping things around, how important are oil exports to the Russian economy?
Russia is, in simple terms, an energy economy from beginning to end. Oil and gas in particular play a really outsized role in the total GDP of Russia. In terms of export earnings, it changes from one year to the next, but often oil and gas represent half of Russia's export earnings. So this is big money. The stakes are very high, and the impacts consequently can be very high. Not so much from the U.S. because our purchases historically were never huge, but if that action is mirrored by others, Russia will not be in a happy place. And already in the last week or so, one has seen repeated indications that Russia is simply having a great deal of difficulty selling its crude. Russia exports just a little bit more than 4.5 million barrels per day onto global markets of crude oil. Something like 3 million barrels a day of Russian crude and refined product has not been finding buyers. So massive discounts have been instituted already. People are picking up cargoes of the Russian, those who are willing to buy are picking up cargoes of Russian crude oil at $20, $25 discount by comparison to the Brent marker crude, the one of the commonly cited grades of crude oil.
Talking to Jonathan Elkind from the Center on Global Energy Policy at Columbia University, looking at the U.S. ban on accepting imports of Russian oil. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions, your reactions. Let's go to your calls now. Ian is with us in Madison. Ian, hello.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. Love the program. Listen to it as often as I can. I just wanted to comment. I drive a diesel truck. My wife has a V8 family Suburban. We're definitely feeling the price of gas going up, but I think that it's worth noting that if this is the price to pay for supporting independence and freedom, that in the long run, it's a very small price to pay. And I think that Americans can shoulder the burden of the price increases over the short term or long term, if necessary, to put enough of the hurt on Putin.
Ian, thanks for the call. That's the case President Biden has been making, I think, John, that Americans will feel this, but it's a price worth paying to stop, to at least hinder Putin's invasion of Ukraine. What do you think of what you heard there from Ian?
Well, I think it's a very important perspective. Look, there are lots of people who have had concerns or question marks about Russian policy through the years. But now we are confronted with what most people thought was unthinkable. So yeah, the world changed. The world looks a whole lot different than it did just 2 weeks ago. And I think that there are a lot of people in this country and around the globe who are saying we really have to think very differently about what's okay to do and what's not.
Thanks for that call. Looking at the bigger picture, this is raising again concerns about the extent to which the U.S. depends on oil imports from anywhere in the world. A couple different solutions people have made the case for, John. One is produce more oil here in the United States, refine more oil into gasoline here in the United States. How big a part of the piece of the part of the puzzle is that?
Well, the oil markets globally function as a single market, essentially. So you pay a little bit more or a little bit less for a higher or lower grade of crude oil, one that is higher in sulfur, tends to be less expensive, one that is more liquid, less viscous, less waxy. You tend to pay a little bit more for. But for all intents and purposes, it's a single global market. And as long as we remain part of that market, there will be limited impact at the pump that comes from whether the gasoline that you're burning in your car is gasoline made from Mexican crude oil or U.S. crude oil or anybody else's. There are, however, political and economic elements of power that Ian, the last caller, was just talking about. That's a different set of facts. It's a different issue. Really, the only way to reduce our vulnerability to the whims of the global oil market is for us to use less oil. That means greater energy efficiency. That means alternative systems, for example, electric vehicles in place of internal combustion engines. But that takes longer to play out. That takes longer to see happen in the marketplace.
I wanted to ask you about that next. It seems as though some European countries are saying, hey, this is a wake-up call to do this in as short a run as possible and stop having to depend on Russian fuel. Do you think this change in the last couple of weeks will kickstart trying to get off of oil dependency?
Well, it's interesting. Yesterday, the European Union announced a proposed new strategy, a proposed new energy strategy that will be debated by heads of state in Paris tomorrow and Friday. That new strategy talks about reducing by two-thirds Europe's purchase of oil and gas from Russia by the end of this year, and reducing as much in advance of 2030, reducing it to zero by as much in advance of 2030 as is possible. So that's some very ambitious steps that they are contemplating. And there will be real impacts in terms of consumer prices across Europe. Now, in this country, we have typically not had a lot of love for any energy policies whatsoever that resulted in big consumer impacts. And so in a way, we've made ourselves persistently vulnerable to some of the energy security and economic hits that go along with that.
We're talking to John Alkine, senior research scholar at the Center on Global Energy Policy at Columbia University. He worked at the Energy Department for nearly a decade. He's talking to us about energy resources, how they factor into the war in Ukraine. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you see this as a reason to accelerate development of renewable energy sources? Do you want to see more oil and natural gas production here in the U.S.? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We're picking up our talk with Columbia University researcher, former Energy Department official John Alkind about American and European efforts to cut back on reliance on Russian energy after the invasion of Ukraine. Let's go back to your calls now at 800-642-1234. Jeff is with us in Barry Mills. Jeff, hi.
Good morning or good afternoon. I was concerned about the misinformation that's spewed over the media about the Keystone Pipeline. I understand that that's oil from the tar sands and it's shipped, you know, going to be piped down to Texas to be refined or just sold as is to countries like China or whoever, you know, being dirty oil with, you know. And I also heard that there are other production leases that are already established in Alaska and elsewhere on federal lands, and that they still can, you know, drill anytime they want to. And I think it's just the oil companies pulling the wool over everybody's eyes.
Jeff, you know, thanks a lot for the call. Jeff referring to a couple of criticisms of the Biden administration from Republicans. One, for blocking the Keystone XL pipeline, also saying that the U.S., that the administration was getting in the way of oil development. Your thoughts, John?
Well, I think it's a pretty hard case to make if one wants to assert that the Biden administration is providing obstacles to the oil and gas industry. The United States is the largest producer of oil in the world, and our production is anticipated to grow in the course of this year alone by somewhere between 700,000 barrels a day and 1.2 million barrels a day, depending on whose outlook you rely upon. So already big, getting even bigger. When we talk to oil company executives, what we hear time and time again is that the limiting factor for their growth of U.S. production has been Wall Street. Wall Street went through a period from the mid-2000s to about the present day, and particularly in the last 5 years, where Wall Street was fed up with seeing returns on investment that were, in the view of those investors, too modest. So Wall Street has leaned really hard on the U.S. oil and gas industry to exercise financial discipline and to return profits to investors. So, you know, you can point to a number of different things that the Biden administration has done that are focused on making sure that we understand properly the climate change impacts that are associated with all parts of our energy economy. But in terms of this notion that the Biden administration is obstructing the growth of the oil and gas industry, that dog won't hunt.
Thanks for that call. We'll go next to Nancy in Minocqua. Nancy, hi.
Hi.
What did you want to ask about, Nancy?
Well, first of all, I wanted to say this is a really great show, and I wanted to give you kudos for that. Second of all, the gentleman that just asked the same question, you know, you hear so much right now, you know, depending upon what channels you listen to and what news sources, and one's bashing it and saying it's the president's job to make the oil prices, and another one's saying, you know, that's totally ridiculous. And I think there's a lot of people in this country that don't understand really who makes the gas prices, and they really don't even understand exactly how much total oil we get shipped into our country. I had done some investigation, and I think it's like 37%, and out of that, Canada gets most of our money. You know, they get the most percentage of what is shipped in. So I'd like that kind of cleared up for people, and you did a good job with the last guy, but maybe you could go a little farther.
Nancy, thanks for the call. First of all, what goes into setting the price of oil and the price we pay at the pump, John? It's not something that a president has a dial and sets the price.
No, the president has very limited ability to, especially in the short run, to change or influence what consumers are paying at the pump. Basically, it's the laws of supply and demand, like how much you see overall economic growth in this country or and around the globe, all of it in aggregate, and how much demand responds to that. Now, there's also an element of the price that reflects expectations tomorrow and the next day, and then out into the future. And this is why you have a curve of future prices for oil. And often you see in a time like today that with pretty elevated prices, today Brent crude went down actually to $111 per barrel. Very good news in my view, because it's been pretty high lately. But, you know, even at $111 a barrel for Brent, that's a pretty elevated price. If you look out several months into the future, the market expects that will get a little bit easier for consumers. But that expectation about where demand and supply are going to be forms a very significant piece of what ultimately gets passed through to you when you're filling your car at the pump.
Thanks for that call. We are talking to John Alkine from Columbia University, looking at oil and gas prices and the ban on U.S. imports of Russian fuel. Back to your calls at 800-642-1234. Tom is with us now in Wild Rose. Hi, Tom.
Hi. My question is, your guest mentioned that the refineries had cut off the Russian oil, and I had heard that before on the news. You know, is that 2 days before the Biden administration, or a month? Are there 40 ships full of oil sitting offshore, or were they sent back, or do we have them stored? I just wondered a little bit more about that story.
Tom, thanks for the call. If oil was on its way from Russia when refineries stopped taking it, when the ban kicked in, what happens to it?
I got to separate my answer to two pieces. Tom, in part, was asking about the so-called overcompliance that one has seen that was already happening before the White House made the announcement yesterday, before the president made the announcement yesterday to ban further purchases. And that was a case where uncertainty in the market and some degree of distaste over what economic actors are seeing in terms of the brutality in Ukraine resulted in people saying, you know what, I'm just not going to go there right now. And this was a pretty big impact. You had banks that were unwilling to issue letters of credit for purchase of Russian crude oil. You had tanker operators that didn't want their tankers to go up into the Black Sea to some of the Russian ports because that was considered to be a war zone. You had ports in the West, including in the United States, that didn't want the Russian tankers coming in. There was one case in Scotland that I saw a reporting on a day or so ago where the port workers said flatly, we're not unloading that tanker, forget it. So a whole bunch of different things coming into play at once. Now, in terms of the announcement that President Biden made yesterday, there are some provisions that allow the winding down of existing contracts over a period of 45 days. This is intended to try to reduce the harmful impact on American households and American motorists. I think that's an appropriate thing to do. We'll see just how much the market reacts to this decision in the days ahead.
In just our last minute or so, what are you watching for on this story, the Russian oil and gas, in the days ahead?
Well, one thing I'm watching is whether there is any kind of a political off-ramp. Mr. Putin has gotten himself and his countrymen into a absolutely terrible situation, barbarically attacking a peaceful neighbor. The answer to that question will have a huge impact on what happens next in energy markets around the globe. But fundamentally, we kind of come back to first principles, which is, before anything else, this is a humanitarian crisis. We have the luxury in the United States of looking at it from afar at a time when people in Ukraine are having their lives and their livelihoods either ended or upended. We need to remember that that's the real tragedy and the real impact of this story.
John, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
It's my pleasure.
Jonathan Elkind is a senior research scholar at the Center on Global Energy Policy at Columbia University, formerly with the U.S. Department of Energy and U.S. Assistant Secretary for International Affairs from 2015 to 2017. He joined us for a look at the U.S. ban on Russian energy imports. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show with Kate Archer-Kent, don't call it a comeback. They've been here for years. Find out why people are getting back into typewriters and how and why they're using them in a computer age. If you're a typewriter fan, definitely want to hear from you. That's tomorrow morning at 8 here on the Ideas Network. Time for some bird updates. A picture is making the rounds online of a snowy owl right over there on the building I'm in right now. A late-night observer caught a picture of the bird on Vilas Hall hanging out on a corner of the roof in the middle of the night. I wasn't here that late, so I didn't see it, but I have had a good run of bird sightings. Over the weekend, just on short walks near lakes in the area, saw a bald eagle out on the edge of the ice near open water having a nice leisurely dinner, two tundra swans coming in for a landing, two sandhill cranes making their way back north, and a red-tailed hawk just hanging out on somebody's rooftop. Not bad for someone who wasn't really trying and doesn't really know much about birds. How about you? Send your cool bird sightings our way. Email centraltime@wpr.org. That's centraltime@wpr.org. We want pictures if you got them. Keep watching the skies. This is Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up, companies involved in making and selling opioids have agreed to a $26 billion settlement over their role in the opioid epidemic. Attorney General Josh Call joins the show to talk about where that money will go and what it will be used for here in Wisconsin. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Carl Christensen with a story about how a box of old cassette tapes connected a Madison musician with his father and his heritage.
Clint Greendeer is a musician and a member of the Ho-Chunk Nation. This is his story about discovering a box of old cassettes and how restoring and archiving the songs on those tapes has connected him with his heritage and his father.
Yeah, those great memories, you know, being raised in my family. It's my mom, my dad, and I'm the youngest out of five, so I'm the baby. A lot of it's like my dad just taking me to Ho-Chunk ceremonies, singing in the car to and from, learning a lot of these songs that are important to us because we're the ones who remember them and keep them going and keep passing them on. My Jaji, or my dad, Conroy Greendeer Sr., he's an amazing singer, and he knew hundreds and hundreds of songs. And my memories of him, you know, listening to other musicians and stuff, he'd still always kind of link that in with our own culture and our heritage. We would definitely be listening to some rock, like Guns N' Roses and stuff, or B.B. King, Louis Armstrong. Like, my dad, he'd always kind of say, like, they all have such beautiful voices and such range. Like, imagine if they were singing all these Wungshik songs with us. Like, that'd be phenomenal. I'd be like, Dad, I don't know if, like, Louis Armstrong is really going to be at the powwow or anything like that, but... My dad passed away about 6 years ago, but now I think, yeah, we came across all of his tapes. He has a huge tape collection. It's got to have hundreds of tapes in there. It's got language tapes. It's got powwow tapes, songs for our ceremonies. A lot of my family kind of reiterated to me, like, oh, gee, you know, your dad has a lot of really important, you know, songs and teachings in all of those tapes. Like, you know, someone should really try to digitize those or something, because, you know, tapes, they can degrade and eventually, you know, they can break. And I was like, okay, well, I should take it upon myself to go through these tapes and at least get them in a digital format. And it's going to be a resource that, you know, myself and younger ones than I will be able to learn from too. Our Ho-Chunk songs, yeah, they go back ice ages ago. They're passed down to us from our ancestors, and that's why my dad, he always put a lot of importance and significance into making sure that he taught me these songs so that, you know, that we can keep these songs alive, keep them going. It's significant to us because, yeah, we're the ones that sing it. We're the ones that teach it to our younger relatives. I was kind of going through the tapes, and then I kind of came across one section where it was just my dad singing by himself, and me just hearing that, you know, it's a very, like, intimate recording of, like, just my dad, and it's, you know, I felt like he was in the room with me. When I come across tapes like those, that's where, you know, I kind of get a, you know, a chill up my spine, because it's, that's a certain kind of energy and certain kind of moments that, you know, I've personally haven't been around because I was so young. I hear those tapes and I'm like, oh yeah, this is why I'm doing this. These are the moments that I love to document. Those kind of moments are great to revisit because it comes to show, you know, he's really not that far away. It's a bit of a tedious and daunting task, but I don't know, it feels good to try to keep those moments, those recordings alive. At least so they can play one last time for me to record it. That's all I need the tape to do. I just need you to get through that one more time playing. All right. my experience with music, it was a different pathway that my dad took. I mean, the path I took was more playing guitar in a band. It's kind of interesting to listen to moments and tracks that, you know, he recorded in his like 20s or getting towards his 30s, and that's like my age now, and it's great to kind of listen to things that he was making at my age. That's such a cool little time capsule for me. It's been cool that I'm able to learn from my dad and still add a little bit of what I've learned through my life, my experience, and being able to make that connection into something completely new. Could I do a send-off in Ho-Chunk? Shigay honey chuck chowie. See you again.
Clint Greendeer is a musician and a member of the Ho-Chunk Nation. Original guitar music, including this song, is by Clint Greendeer. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook. I'm Carl Christensen.
Coming up, we'll talk to Wisconsin Attorney General Josh Call about the hundreds of millions of dollars coming to Wisconsin as part of a settlement from opioid drug lawsuits. That's next here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Now, drug makers and distributors have agreed to pay $26 billion to settle claims alleging they contributed to the opioid epidemic. Under that agreement, Wisconsin will receive more than $400 million of that funding. So how will that money be divided up across the state? How will it be used to deal with Wisconsin's opioid crisis? Wisconsin Attorney General Josh Call joins us now. Attorney General Call, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
$400 million coming from this settlement for Wisconsin. How does that get divided up?
Yeah, this money is going to transform our response to the opioid epidemic, and it's the result of years of investigation and, in some cases, litigation. Under state law, 70% of the money that Wisconsin receives is going to go to county and local governments that were involved in litigation over the opioid epidemic. The other 30% is going to go to our State Department of Health Services, and those funds need to be used to support efforts to fight the opioid epidemic. And how exactly they get allocated is going to be decided by those county and local governments and by the Department of Health Services.
For the state part of this, what's the plan for using this money to help combat the opioid epidemic?
The Department of Health Services will ultimately decide where those funds go, and I know that they're in the process right now of engaging in listening sessions. My hope is to see those funds, though, go towards long-term investments that can help us ultimately beat this epidemic, including funding things like treatment programs, prevention programs, and recovery programs.
Looking at the bigger picture of this settlement, this comes from Johnson & Johnson for their production and marketing of opioids, and three really big companies that aren't household names that distribute it. They're the ones that pharmacies, for example, buy from. Can you talk about why the state was involved in this lawsuit, what you hoped to get out of it?
One of my priorities as Attorney General has been to strengthen our response to the opioid epidemic, and as part of that effort, we've been making sure we're taking a hard line when it comes to holding Big Pharma accountable for its role in this epidemic. We sued Purdue Pharma in my first year in office, and we also joined multi-state investigations into these three distributors. And one of the things we allege in the complaint we filed against Purdue Pharma is that the opioid epidemic didn't need to happen. It happened for a variety of reasons, but including that pharmaceutical companies engaged in false and deceptive marketing practices, or in some cases looked the other way when there were prescriptions that they had to have known couldn't have been legitimate. Holding those companies accountable is important to make sure that this never happens again. But it's also important because it brings resources to the state of Wisconsin that can go towards these efforts to fight the epidemic. And now we're seeing the results of that with this more than $400 million that's going to be coming to the state.
as I understand it, none of the companies in this settlement admitted to wrongdoing as part of the settlement. Do you wish that you had held out for that, you and the many other entities involved in this lawsuit had held out for that?
Well, you always want to see people acknowledge their responsibility for any conduct that violates the law. But we didn't want to let those sorts of issues stop us from bringing dollars to our communities that can help fight the opioid epidemic now. As a result of this resolution, there's going to be about $50 million coming to Wisconsin this year, and then an additional $350 million plus over a number of years going forward. And it's also important to note that this isn't the only matter involving opioid distributors or manufacturers. We are in bankruptcy proceedings involving Purdue Pharma, for example, and there could be other cases as well. And our goal is to get as many dollars to our communities in the state as we can to help people with the fight against the opioid epidemic.
Unfortunately, by a lot of measures, the opioid epidemic in the U.S. has gotten worse over the last couple of years. What do you see as the biggest areas of concern right now?
There are two things that I think are really driving the spike that we have seen. One is the pandemic has strained all sorts of resources and ties between people, and that's had a number of different negative effects on people's health and on both their mental health and their physical health. And it's also led to, I think, an increase in substance use disorder. So partly we need to make sure we're investing in treatment and recovery programs that can help people who are struggling with substance use disorder. The other thing we've seen is a lot of fentanyl being sold illegally. Fentanyl is an incredibly potent opioid. It's far more dangerous than even heroin and other opioids. And it often gets mixed in with other drugs without people knowing. And it's really critical that people are aware of the dangers of ingesting fentanyl, and that they're aware that they may not even know that they're taking fentanyl and it can lead to overdose deaths. So the more that we can do to prevent all types of substance use disorder, the more that we're going to be able to reduce opioid-related overdose deaths.
What efforts are underway to try to stop the flow of fentanyl into Wisconsin?
I think there are a few things. One is we need to try to reduce the demand for all different types of drugs, and that means engaging in treatment and diversion efforts, like I've been talking about, and also prevention efforts to make clear to people before they become addicted the dangers of becoming addicted to any kind of narcotic. But also we need to make sure that there's a strong enforcement effort. Partly that means discouraging overprescription so people don't become addicted to opioids and then ultimately turn to illegal opioids, and there's been some real success on that front. But it also means making sure that we are engaging in long-term intensive investigations into drug trafficking networks so that those who are bringing these drugs into Wisconsin and other states are investigated and ultimately prosecuted and put behind bars.
On the initial problem of overprescription of opioids, do you think we're doing better now than we were at the outset of this latest surge in opioid use?
I think we are doing better when it comes to the prescription front. The number of opioids that are prescribed is still far above where it was a little over 20 years ago. But it's also decreased pretty significantly over the last several years. And there are a number of steps that we've taken both in Wisconsin and nationally that have helped that, including things like the prescription drug monitoring program, which helps, among other things, prevent people from going to multiple doctors. I think the message has also gotten out that there had been overprescription, and that's caused some prescribers to rethink their practices in a way that's been helpful. And we've made sure that people are aware that there's a danger to opioid use, even if it's from a prescription. So we're making progress there, but we've also got to make sure that for people who are addicted, that they have access to treatment programs and recovery programs so they're not left to potentially turn to illegal opioids like heroin or fentanyl, but instead are able to get the help that they need to address their addiction.
For those kind of treatment and recovery programs, we hear there's a pressing need for them. This settlement we're talking about, is this enough money to put even a dent in our needs here?
Yeah, I think that this will make a significant difference in our response. It's not going to be all the resources that we need to fight the opioid epidemic, and it certainly doesn't match the harm and the devastation that the opioid epidemic has caused. But, you know, to put this in perspective, you know, the $50 million coming to the state of Wisconsin this year far exceeds the amount that we spend annually on the treatment alternatives and diversion program, which helps people who end up in the criminal justice system get access to treatment. So this will really reinforce our efforts, but it can't be the only thing we're doing. We need to continue investing in fighting this epidemic because it continues to be devastating to people across the state and across the country.
Wisconsin Attorney General Josh Call is with us for a look at this new opioid drug settlement. A lot of money coming into Wisconsin. And I want to turn Attorney General Call to a couple other legal issues related to Wisconsin. We've got the state Supreme Court ruling on the state's redistricting plan, going with the latest effort from Governor Evers to meet their standard of least changes. Now Republican lawmakers going to the U.S. Supreme Court, looking to turn it back to their initial plan. Is the State Department of Justice going to be involved in that if it goes to the U.S. Supreme Court?
Yes, we will. I've been representing Governor Evers, as have some of my colleagues. You know, the original ruling from the State Supreme Court that it was going to minimize changes to the current maps was one we had argued against. We thought that there should be a fair map process so that we have truly nonpartisan maps. But Governor Evers then submitted the maps that best met the test that the state Supreme Court had set, which was to minimize changes. And in doing so, he also submitted maps that are fairer. They're still not neutral, but they're fairer than the prior maps. And they best met the criteria that the state Supreme Court had set. I'm confident that those maps are going to remain in place as the appeal process plays out. And we will continue to be engaged in that litigation on behalf of representing Governor Evers and ultimately to serve the best interests of Wisconsinites.
If this goes before the U.S. Supreme Court, what argument would you make that they should stay with the maps that the state Supreme Court went with?
Well, usually the federal courts defer to the state court judgments and state practices when states set maps. You know, we will see exactly what arguments are raised here. But so far, the U.S. Supreme Court has been reluctant this year to get involved in maps that have been put in place in other states. There have been several places now where the U.S. Supreme Court has said that we're too close to the election to get involved. I expect that we're going to see something similar here. But also the maps that were adopted in Wisconsin comply with all the applicable laws. And, you know, the state Supreme Court used the standard it had set, and Governor Evers' maps best met that standard. So I expect that they'll remain in place.
You mentioned the time consideration here. The clock is ticking April 15th. Candidates start circulating nomination papers for elections later this year. If the U.S. Supreme Court did flip the decision from the state Supreme Court here, is there time to change the maps in, what, just over a month?
I don't think there is because, you know, first the State Election Commission had asked to have maps in place by the beginning of this month. The state Supreme Court wasn't quite able to do that, but it was very close, and there is time now to get everything set. But if the U.S. Supreme Court weighs in here, they would be invalidating the map, and we'd have to go through a new map drawing process, and that would make the whole process, it would really require a restart of the whole process. So I don't, for that reason, as well as some of the other reasons we talked about, I don't expect that to happen, and I'm confident that it won't.
And former state Supreme Court Justice Michael Gabelman released his second interim report last week in his ongoing investigation chartered by the state assembly leader looking into the 2020 elections. Do you have response to his calls to get rid of the Wisconsin Election Commission or his urging of lawmakers to take a look at the idea of somehow decertifying the outcome of that election?
The Voss-Gabelman investigation is an embarrassment to our state. It is a waste of tax dollars. It has embraced conspiracy theories that have already been addressed and rejected. And he's also bought into what are really fringe legal theories, including the theory that the state legislature, the politicians, can overturn the democratic results of an election, even if they've been certified by a court. I mean, that's really extreme and anti-democratic. I think that the Voss-Gabelman investigation shouldn't be given any consideration. And it's telling, I think, that even Republican lawmakers in Wisconsin aren't coming back into session to act on Justice Gabelman's report. Instead, they are going home for the year. So I don't think that report has been given really any credibility by even Republican legislators. And I think people should just ignore it.
Attorney General Call, thanks again for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
That's Attorney General Josh Call with us today to talk about how Wisconsin will distribute its share of the new $26 billion opioid drug settlement, plus a look at a couple of election-related issues here in Wisconsin. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, some schools are turning to private sponsorships or naming rights to help meet their budget needs. We'll find out what's going on, what's legal and what isn't, and you could share your thoughts on the idea. You can get started right now. Is this something you're seeing in your own community? Is the stadium, say, at the high school, does it have the name of a local business on it? Let us know. Email centraltime@wpr.org. That's centraltime@wpr.org. Also tomorrow, a UW Oshkosh class has a unique project trying to solve cold cases here in Wisconsin. Find out what they've accomplished so far and what's in the works. That's tomorrow here on Central Time. Up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then we look at political trends in rural parts of Wisconsin with a move toward Republicans in recent elections and what it all means for this year's midterms. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we talk to a former Energy Department employee about the U.S. ban of Russian oil and gas imports and the role of energy resources in national security. First, rural areas and small towns in Wisconsin have been trending more conservative and more Republican. For example, hundreds of smaller communities went for Barack Obama in his two election campaigns and went for Trump in 2016 and 2020. That's not just Wisconsin. States around the country are seeing similar trends in rural communities. So what's going on? How do we account for this ideological divide between more rural and urban parts of the state? How are the Democrats and the Republicans responding? You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you listening from a rural part of the state? What do you see going on near you? Do you talk about politics in your neck of the woods, or is it a difficult conversation to have? Do you feel like things are divided or united on one side or the other? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Anthony Chergosky is an assistant professor of political science at UW La Crosse. His specialties include American and Wisconsin political campaigns and elections, political communication, and mass media. Anthony, welcome back to Central Time. Do we have Anthony? We will reconnect with Anthony, it looks like. In the meantime, you can join in at 800-642-1234. Why do you think there's a big divide between rural and urban communities, a growing partisan divide based in part on geography? If you live in a rural part of the state, what do you want to hear from either party or both parties? What do you think they're missing about your community? Do they pay attention to you at all? Call 800-642-1234. Anthony Chergosky is with us now. Anthony, welcome back to the show. Okay, I think we got you now, Anthony. Hi.
All there right. We are. Nice okay. to be with you, Rob.
That last one was on our end, I know. Now, Wisconsin not alone in this trend, rural voters turning more toward Republicans, conservatives. Big picture, what are we seeing with trends in Wisconsin around the country?
Well, Rob, I think you make an important observation that the rural-urban political divide is not unique to Wisconsin. Mm-hmm. We've seen this widening gap all around the country where Republicans are gaining ground in rural areas, Democrats are continuing to build their support in urban areas, but there is a unique aspect of Wisconsin in this urban-rural divide, and Rob, it's simply put that Wisconsin has a more intense urban-rural political divide than most other states. The urban-rural divide is particularly pronounced in Wisconsin. The urban-rural divide has widened before it widened in other states, and it really structures politics in Wisconsin to an extent that it doesn't in other states. So, sure, the urban-rural divide is present in all states, and urban-rural politics have always been an issue in the United States, but here in Wisconsin, it is particularly strong, and I would say, Rob, that it is a defining feature of Wisconsin politics, the urban-rural political divide.
Okay, why Wisconsin?
Well, a couple reasons, Rob. First, Wisconsin politicians have been particularly aggressive in exploiting the urban-rural divide. We've seen politicians in their campaigns and in their rhetoric try to pit urban areas against rural areas for the purposes of winning elections. Some of this has come in the form of saying, hey, this other party has forgotten about you in this geographic area, or we're going to serve your area unlike the other party. So what has happened, Rob, is that the geographic divide in Wisconsin now overlaps almost perfectly with the partisan divide. And when you have two very strong divides overlapping like that, the incredible partisan divide and the incredible geographic divide, when you have two very stark lines of division overlapping, that is a recipe for some serious conflict.
A couple of articles lately have looked at this, not just in terms of the vote counts, though that's a big part of the story, but about life in rural communities for the few remaining Democrats there feeling like nervous about expressing their political views publicly, feeling ostracized in their communities. It's not just the voting, it's that the Democratic brand is seen as an outside force in some ways in a lot of communities. You tweeted about that. What do you make of things at that level beyond what the final vote tallies are?
Rob, this really reflects the extent to which the urban-rural divide is about identity politics. By that, I mean how political party has become baked into people's identity. So when we hear about the intense partisan conflict in rural areas, how people are hostile and how there are uncomfortable conversations, that does not just reflect a policy divide between the parties. It reflects a more fundamental identity divide where political party has become so important to people, it is now part of their identity. There is strong evidence in political science to show this, that it's one thing to say that I align with the Republican Party or I align with the Democratic Party. But now what we're seeing is people saying, I am a Democrat. I am a Republican. It's part of their identity, just as their geographic area has become part of their identity. Whether they're a rural resident or an urban resident, that has become baked into their identity. So the reason this conflict is particularly vicious, in my view, is that it's not just a policy battle. This is about people's sense of identity. This is about people's sense of who they are. And that leads to some really uncomfortable situations, some real political hostility.
Talking to Anthony Trigosky, assistant professor of political science at UW La Crosse, looking at the political divide, the urban-rural divide, especially in Wisconsin, and focusing on rural Wisconsin in particular, moving conservative, moving Republican. You can join in with your thoughts at 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Lots of callers. Let's bring them on. Eric is with us in the Village of Endeavor. Eric, hi.
Hey, how you doing? I live in rural Wisconsin, and I'm surrounded by Trump signs and Trump 2020 everything. My next door neighbor's had his flag at half mast since November 3rd, 2020. He has got hand painted Biden sucks signs, and he's still adding bumper stickers to his truck. It's kind of interesting.
Eric, you referring to other people as Trump supporters? Do you fit in there? Do you feel like, are you on one side or the other? How does that all affect you?
Well, I was a registered Republican most of my life, but a few years ago, I started looking into things a little more. And let's say I didn't vote for Biden, but I did vote against Trump. So, yeah, I voted for Biden.
Eric, thanks for the call. Thanks for sharing your story there. Anthony, Eric pointing toward not just everybody around him is a Republican or Trump supporter, but very vocal and visual about it.
And Rob, that is exactly what I'm talking about when I talk about identity politics. You know, people wouldn't be so vocal about their political points of view if they tended to support one party or another just because they kind of agreed with one party's policy stances or they kind of aligned with one party's ideology a little more than another. But now, which candidate people support is a fundamental feature of who they consider themselves to be as a person, and which political party they support is a fundamental feature of who they consider themselves to be as a person. And we see this in rural areas, especially where people are identifying themselves as rural residents, that is a part of who they think they are, and that their political party affiliation is a part of who they think they are. That's the same thing going on in urban areas, but to the caller's point, it can make things uncomfortable for those who don't quite fit in with the crowd in these geographic areas.
Thanks for that call. We'll go to Bella now in Racine. Bella, hi.
Hi there. How are you?
Good. What did you want to bring up, Bella?
Well, my comment is that I am total agreement with what is being said, and I'm in the scene. It's a mixed bag, and I think that our formerly twice disgraced leader in charge gaslit what a lot of people are feeling in various places as they see times change. More people of color are moving into suburbs and rural areas, and now all of a sudden there's a fear. There's nowhere to run. There's nowhere to hide. And you don't know who your neighbor's going to be. In addition to the complicated factors of these areas, I lived over near Dodgeville. These areas have very limited news sources, TV, cable and stuff. One, you can only get one or two. The phones go in and out. You don't have even kids that can be homeschooled or get virtual lessons. So people don't have all the information, and these areas are saturated. When we look at one or two places in the United States where we have owners who have bought up all the news channels around these places, Vermont, Wisconsin, all over the place, to keep people in the dark about what's going on.
Bella, thanks a lot for that call. A couple of big points Bella's making there. First, concern maybe in rural communities about change, unwelcome change, and news deserts almost.
Rob, I think those are extremely important points. There is good evidence in political science that when local news declines, people lean into their political party identity. People become more intense in their partisanship. And I think that's exactly what you're seeing around the country. And it is a great concern to see the decline of local news because it feeds into the partisan conflict. It makes people double and triple down on their political party affiliation. To the caller's other point, I think she makes a very important observation. The Democrats want to try to cut into the rural deficit they have by focusing on bread and butter issues like rural broadband and agriculture. And as Tony Evers mentioned in his State of the State, more funding for rural emergency services. But what if this isn't really about bread and butter economic issues? What if this is really more about the culture wars and identity politics and the anxieties associated with a changing America? If that's the case, then I'm not sure the Democrats really have a great answer for what's happening in rural areas. They can certainly try to appeal to rural areas with economic benefits and trying to speak to the economic needs of rural areas. But if that's not what this conflict is actually about, then the Democrats may find their efforts to be unsuccessful.
Bella, thanks for the call. We're talking to Anthony Chergosky, assistant professor of political science at UW La Crosse, looking at why rural and small towns in Wisconsin have been voting more and more for Republican candidates over the years. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Are we talking about your community? Are you in touch with the local political scene where you live? Do people talk about politics, debate politics, or issues? Call it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time.